The Touching the Trail Podcast. Touching the Trail Podcast, episode 44. So today's podcast guest is Jeff Browning. I have been wanting to have him on the podcast for a very long time. He is probably my favorite ultra runner and someone who I look up to a lot, someone who I follow closely on social media and love seeing what he's up to and what he can do. And he's done it all. He's done a lot. And he's just so incredible at what he does, the way he performs at races, the way he executes a race, and the way he just all around his whole personality. So I'm very happy and very excited to have him on the show today. I'm recording this intro actually right before I'm about to pull him up on Skype. So really looking forward to that. He has been running for a very long time, since about 2001. And he has done many, many races, incredible races. He's done four races, 400 milers this year alone. The Hurt 100 in Hawaii, the Western States 100, the Hard Rock 100, and the Run 100. So he somehow just can, you know, bounce back from a race and train again hard and be injury-free mostly, and then just be able to attack the next race and compete very at the very top. So I am very excited to find out how he does it. A lot of podcasts talk about what he eats. He is a high-fat, low-carb, moderate-protein kind of diet. And, you know, we have all these names for all these different diets. I'm vegan. He's what he is. So maybe there's a little, you know, confliction. I don't really care about that for this episode. I love on the podcast to talk about diet and food and an eating lifestyle and eating how people eat. But since it's been covered so often, I think that is something that you can find out for your own on other podcasts that, you know, delve into that much more. On this episode, I really want to talk about his grit, how he can endure and suffer through, since he's so good at that. The Western States and Hard Rock double that he did this summer, which he has the fastest combined time. His conservation efforts with Patagonia National Park and all those things. How he's always tinkering, how he's always cutting his shoes and cutting his shorts and sewing them and finding a better way to use his gear. And just how, like I said, mainly how he can endure and how he suffers through and just enjoys it all, his whole lifestyle. He's a very busy guy. He's a graphic designer. He has three kids and a wife and an ultra runner. And so I'm very excited for this episode, and I hope you are too. I hope we both learn a lot about Jeff Browning and how we can all endure a little bit better. So, Jeff Browning. For a while now, you've been someone who's just like really inspired me, and your ultra running is really something that I can look up to, and I've always, for a while now, loved what you've been capable of. And to me, you know, what you do out there, and especially this year with the double at Western and at Hard Rock, it's just something that seems elegant, you know what I mean? Something that seems just not like you're just suffering through, but like you're just, I think you just really show the love of the sport, and you transform, you know, that suffering into something that's really inspiring. So I guess to start off with a pretty big question, but, you know, how do you endure? How do you, you know, what's your philosophy on that?
Well, probably number one is just I love running and the adventure of it. You know, I love being in the mountains or the woods or whatever, as long as it's kind of a natural space. I'm pretty into it, and I have been for a long time. You know, I grew up born and raised on a farm in the Midwest, and, you know, so I was always outside, you know, rarely inside unless I was, you know, forced to be inside. So, you know, I was charging out in the rain and all that kind of stuff when I was a kid. And then, you know, as I got older, I got into mountain biking in college and in the early 90s. And then that kind of connected me with endurance training and my love of the outdoors. And so when I moved to Bend, I kind of found ultra running. And I think I like the simplicity and how primal it is. So, you know, it's just, I don't have to worry about like making sure my gears are shifting correctly or my tires have proper air pressure in them and that kind of stuff. So I definitely, you know, that's what attracted me to ultra running in the first place. So the kind of the long answer is that I just love being outside. And so, you know, I've learned after, you know, that was, you know, I've done 2600s now, and I really like have learned to embrace the suffering a little bit and know it's going to come and just kind of like make friends with pain a little bit. And I think any, you know, if you look at the history of endurance sports, you know, that's kind of what, if you can't do that, you're not going to stick around the sport very long. Right. You have to find like the primal connection in it. And if you can, if it's just for competition or if it's just for ego or I'm going to, you know, X amount of wins or podium finishes or whatever, that's not really what it's about. So, and you're going to be, you know, at some point you're going to, you know, we see this a lot with fast guys, especially that they burn out and right. We don't see them anymore, you know, and I'm here to, I mean, personally, I want to be running to in my 80s. So, so I'm trying to be, you know, do things that's going to give me longevity and also embrace, you know, my race schedule and do the kind of bucket list items I want to do, but also, you know, I kind of just roll with it. Like if, you know, with the double, I didn't even think about doing the double until I was in the lottery at Hard Rock and got in and then found out I could get into Western States through Ultra. And that's when I was like, oh, well, someone said, oh, there's a double record. And that's when my wheels started turning. And, you know, and then I, you know, that's kind of how that came about. So
right. And Nick Clark, you saw his record and you started thinking, because I watched the double movie and that was a... That was awesome. But, yeah, so, and then how did you transfer into competitive ultra running once you found ultra running?
Well, like, at first, you know, I came to it just to run. I'd heard about Western States and I wanted to run it. And, I kind of saw it as like a life bucket list, you know, like, you know, the old school way of people say, oh, I'm going to run a marathon someday. I was kind of like, well, I want to run a 100-miler when I heard about it. I had heard about marathons, but had not heard about, I didn't know about these races. And when I found out about it, it piqued my interest. And I don't know, the pioneer adventurer in me, in my blood kind of, you know, said, hey, you should do that. And so I kind of just saw it as like, hey, I'm gonna do it and move on and keep mountain biking, climbing and that kind of stuff. But in the process of getting in the lottery and, you know, qualifying with 50 miler and all those things you have to do to get into Western States, I got hooked and, you know, I've always been kind of geeky about training and, you know, reading stuff. And, I'm very well read as far as like, training philosophies, different kinds of training philosophies, nutrition, that kind of stuff. And that's just kind of my own thing and that I'm into. And so, you know, I kind of just kept kind of just finishing ultras. And then I think Western States was probably the first time I ever thought about like, huh, first 100 got under 24 hours. Maybe I could do these faster. And I come from a competitive background in high school of like, I won my conference 800 meter, my senior year and was all conference wide receiver in football. So I was like fiercely competitive in high school, but I kind of just, in college, I went for education. I went to a bigger university and found mountain biking was kind of casual. But I think there's probably some part of me that really wanted to still, cause we still did all kind of with between friends, there was friendly competition in college right. And mountain biking and, you know, trying to clear some technical section or something like that or hit a jump that, you know, higher than anyone else. And I think, you know, that's always been a part of me is competition has been really great and I love it and it drives me at times. And so I just started like geeking out about whether I could like get a little faster in 100 milers. And that led me back to, you know, I've always been into strength training. So I worked on muscle imbalances. I worked on speed. I started doing a ton of reading on run, you know, endurance training. And you know, slowly got faster, worked on form. I got kind of hold of like chi running and some good form. I found some really old, from like the 50s, good form running stuff. And that led me to chi running. And then I kind of worked on my form in 04. I was having some like issues. And so in the off season, I did some strength training to correct those muscle imbalances. And then also worked on cadence and form. And that's before there was all this good form running talk that we have today. And that really helped. I mean, that's when I like came back and like, oh, I got like fifth. In 04, I got like fifth at Wasatch and ran under 24 hours. And then came back the next year and won Bighorn. And that was my first like 100-mile win. And that kind of got me like, once you get a win, like you're kind of, they're a little addictive. And and so then you're like, man, I can do better, you know? And so then I came back to Bighorn and won again in 06 and got the course record. And then I was like really hooked on like trying to get better, trying to get faster. And then from there, just kind of like, I think I'm almost pretty much every year since then, I've at least won 100. So like that's been, you know, I mean, winning gets you kind of addicted to trying to be better. Right. So,
and I think, you know, like you said, you did all that research into the books and everything, and then the podcasts I've listened with you on it, and, you know, the things I've read, you know, it seems like that's a very important aspect of your racing and running personality. That, you know, on the Ultra Runner podcast, I heard that you print out the maps before the race, like a month before, and look at it every day, and you said right here that you read the books and everything. So, you know, how do you do that research? Do you have like a starting point that you're like, all right, this is what I want to know, or do you want to just like learn everything about it, or do you know what I mean?
Well, I kind of go with my nose, you know, like a hound dog. So I'm a type of person that just, when I find out something new or something piques my interest, I kind of have to follow it through to the end. Mm-hmm. That's just my personality. My wife gets kind of annoyed sometimes because I will like get really into something and I can't put it down. Like I'll read till 3 a.m. and I just can't put it away until I've kind of absorbed it. Mm-hmm. And I've made friends with it and like understand the concept. So whatever it is, you know, whether it's nutrition, you know, I did that with, you know, when I switched to like a high fat, low carb diet about a year ago or almost a year ago, before this last season, I just totally like engulfed myself in like the science behind it. I read, you know, I got in the weeds with science books. I got in the weeds. I read, you know, political books on like how fat was demonized and what the money trail behind it and like all this stuff. And like, I think it doesn't matter what the subject is, whether it's a course, that's just my personality. And like, mm-hmm. I have to follow my nose. And I think that's probably why, I mean, one of the reasons that I like in being an endurance coach, because every single person's a puzzle, and you have to figure out the puzzle. So right. You have to say, okay, yeah, this is a symptom, but what could be causing that issue, or why are they having problems here? If we tweak this, it might fix this, but if that doesn't work, we might tweak this. Like there's all the kinds of like ways you can come about it, and everyone's different and everyone has a different background. And so, you know, that kind of stuff really intrigues me and I get into it. And so I guess I have to follow it. And I'm not everyone's like that. Some people need someone to tell them what to do and can't follow their nose necessarily. But I totally I like to look at all the sides too. You know, I like to read like, okay, if that's, you know, I don't ever necessarily, I question everything. So I don't necessarily say everything is truth. You know, even with diet, I think that Tony Horton, the guy that does P90X,
right.
he says he's a flexitarian. And I like that. Like, he's flexible. Like, as we find out new things, we're willing to, like, roll with it and change a little bit or shift our focus a little. So, you know, that's what I would say, you know, if you say diet, I'm more of a flexitarian than I am anything else. I'm not a vegetarian. I'm not a paleo guy.
Right.
I do like, I mean, I probably most align with Primal Blueprint, but mm-hmm. As far as how I eat right now, but you know, that could change. I don't know. Like right now I'm following it. I feel great. You know, I've had a lot of good health benefits from it and recovery benefits. So, you know, you just got to follow your nose with any kind of information, whether it's course course maps or nutrition books or whatever.
Right. And even with that, you know, the diet that you're taking on right now, like you said, the high fat, low carb kind of thing, and the Primal Blueprint, you know, I was reading that you have a garden at your house and you love to garden and you grew up on a 700-acre farm. So I think that even reaches back to your childhood and running to that connection to the earth and that just like simple essence of the earth.
Yeah, there's nothing better than growing your own vegetables and then going out to the garden and actually eating vegetables straight from the dirt, like before you even bring it inside, like right. Munch while you're picking. There's nothing cooler, I mean, to connect you to the earth, but also to just to like get your hands dirty. Like, it's really a cool process. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a few years to kind of get the hang of it. I picked it up in my 30s, 30s gardening. And, it was a learning experience. I hadn't really gardened. My grandfather was a big gardener, mm-hmm. you know, and my dad kind of dabbled in it, but he wasn't really into it. And so I was always at my grandfather's house, who always lived a quarter mile away, and he had a huge garden. You know, you could go there and like he had melons and corn and like corn on the cob and all, you know, tomatoes. Like, you could go eat in his garden. And so I think, you know, there was something in that that I thought was really cool as a kid, but I never really got into it. And then finally, like, I was just kind of doing some, like, permaculture reading. I really got into, like, maybe I almost, in, like, the late 2000s, my wife and I almost moved back to the Midwest to buy land and live off the grid. And so at the time, I was really into this, like, researching, like, permaculture and, like, how to do balanced, like, you know, like, look at a property and, like, if the water's flowing a certain way, how do you catch your water? And, like, how do you catch water off your roof and garden, you know, water your garden? And so all these little things. And we started getting, like, backyard chickens at the time, and I started doing a garden. And it took a good 3 or 4 years to, like, figure out how to improve the soil. And, like, I had a couple bad crops. You know, it was a learning experience. And a couple times I got really frustrated with it, but I kept with it. And then, you know, you just kind of figure it out after a while through trial and error.
Yeah. And you, that whole, like, gardening kind of, like, aspect of your life seems like just another example of how you're always tinkering, you know, even on your Patagonia, you know, sponsored a little page. It says that you're always tinkering with your gear and everything. And that whole research kind of, like, personality aspect, I think is very important to your racing and to your ability to perform in life and in the trails. So, you know, you do tinker with your gear. So tell me a little bit about that and how you're always changing things up.
Well, because I'm, you know, 21 years career as a graphic designer, one of the things you do in design is one of the philosophies is form follows function. And so you're always trying to strip away extra stuff. So it's like, why is this here? You always are questioning, why is this in this location and why is it here? So that carries over to everything. That can carry over to life in general. Like, why do I have all this stuff around me and cluttering my house? You know, I'm cleaning my house all the time because I have too much crap. So there's all kinds of, you know, philosophies behind this. And it's like the model of just stripping things away. And so it still functions, right? The way is intended to function without any extra anything on it.
Right.
And I think that's why I like being involved with a footwear company, because, you know, trying to say, well, if we take this overlay off, do we really need that overlay? Okay, I understand that it's got a function, right? It's trying to to help with abrasion or, like, blowout. Mm-hmm. But, okay, why do we have this other one right back here, you know, on the heel? Like, do we really need that? Like, can we take that off? That'll shed some weight. You know, there's all kinds of, like, ways you can look at gear, and the same with, like, packs or, you know, all kinds of stuff. Like, how can we simplify to the point where there's just enough for it to function the way it should function.
Right, it's most optimal.
The way it should perform. And still have longevity. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there's a balance between function and longevity, especially with any kind of product, whether we're talking about running packs or shoes or clothing, you know, that you can't make something so light that it's just going to, like, wear out constantly, because that's not good. One, it's not good for the planet.
Right.
And two, it's not good for the consumers, like, look at your brand when they look at it and go, wow, I had that, super expensive, and it lasted 3 months.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's kind of how I look at things as far as tinkering. I'm always just trying to strip things away in my head. And it's one of those, too, that's like, it's like the hound dog idea of following something through. I have to kind of do that. And I've ruined some shoes, man. Like, luckily I have a sponsor. So, you know, because I've cut things to the point where it's like, I went out and ran in, and I'm like, oh, I just ruined these shoes. Like, that last thing I did to it ruined it. You know, you tinker, you take a little off. I've learned over the years that you take a little off, you go test it. You take a little more off, you go test it. And hopefully you don't go too far.
Right. Finding so that edge.
That's the idea.
Yeah, and you know that again, it stems from that like idea of just finding, like, doing the most research and following with your nose and following it to the end. And since you followed so much to the nose, I was wondering, you know, you're sponsored by Goose, so of course that's what you take on races. But have you ever experimented with eating real food on runs and races?
Yeah, I've even tried to, like, mix my own gels, like sweet potatoes and mixing all kinds of other stuff in, like, a blender.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years. What I find is what's the biggest pain with that kind of stuff is the shelf life. So it doesn't last very long, so you have to, like, constantly make it. It's a pain when you're on the road to travel for races. And, you know, it's hard to get the mixes exactly right every time. So then it tastes totally, like, too salty this time and not salty enough the next time. And so what I figured too was, like, after all that tinkering, I just kind of figured out that what really matters is your everyday diet.
Right.
And then that race day or that long run is like a blip on the radar screen. And so that's when it's like all bets are off. And, like, I don't worry about whether I'm taking in simple sugar or gels or, you know, drinks or whatever. I've just kind of simplified. And that's kind of my race philosophy is a very simple palate. Like, taking in a little bit of Roctane, a few gels here and there strategically, and some banana chips. And that's really... You know, a little bit of fruit at the tables, fruit and potatoes maybe, and maybe a little broth at night or something. Or if someone has avocado, occasionally I've eaten bacon late in a race. But I always regret eating bacon because it always messes with your stomach because your body can't break down that protein when you're exercising. So
right.
It always sounds good, but it always kind of like messes with my stomach. So I love it. Like, I did it at Hurt. But it was the last 20 miles, and had a good lead, and so I really enjoyed it, and mm-hmm. like just said, heck with it, and ate some bacon, and just dealt with it. But you know, like, I just try to keep it simple. And Goo, I was using Goo before I, you know, approached them for a sponsorship. So you know, that's why I approached them, because I have a connection with our local running shop and help them brand and market as a designer and. And so over the years, I didn't really have to have any kind of sponsorship with footwear or nutrition because I had the shop.
Right.
And I would just try everything, which was awesome. In the first, like, 6 or 7 years of running, I tried, like, every brand that was out there, you know, whether it was, you know, Hammer or Cliff or whoever. And I kind of settled on Goo that sat with me personally. And I know some people that can't do it.
Right.
You know, they can't do that brand. You know, you have to tinker as a whatever you're doing in endurance, like from a nutritional standpoint, you got to tinker and try stuff in long runs. And some stuff you're going to go out there and go, whoa, that did not work. And then other days you're going to be like, wow, that was awesome. That's a staple.
Right.
So, but you have to test it.
Yeah. And, you know, you said that, you know, it's about the bigger diet and the bigger lifestyle and what you're eating in terms of, like, you know, they say in weightlifting that, you know, your muscles are built after the workout. And in ultra running, I think it's the same thing that you do the run, but then you get home and it's about what you eat, how you recover. And
absolutely.
Yeah. How you strength train. Like you say, you know, that's a very big aspect of your training regimen. So it's all about, you know, the run is the fun part. It's you put in the work and you enjoy it and you suffer, and then you get home and you have to put in more work, and it's not just sit on the couch and it's over. It's something else that you still have to do.
Well, I think that's one of the things that, you know, I did it for years where I didn't really worry about what I was putting in after workouts when I was younger. But as I got older, that stuff starts to catch up to you. And your metabolic system is just like, you know, it leaches from other places to deal with it and, like, repair itself. And you don't realize it's doing that behind the scenes. But it is. It's leaching from your bones. It's leaching from organs. It's leaching from all kinds of places and causing issues over time. And that just slowly, like baby steps, you know, totally messes with you. And so for me in 2015 is when it kind of came to a head. But what I see is like a lot of runners and endurance athletes doing that, you know, just saying, you know what, I earned this and I'm going to go eat like crap.
Yeah.
You know, and you can't. Really, you can't do that. And if I could tell my 20-something-year-old self, you know, that give them tip, that would be my tip. Like, take care of yourself. Eat well now, because you're going to be that much stronger when you're 45 compared to, like, having to fix yourself in your 40s, like I see a lot of people having to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's preventative, not fixative. I don't know the other word.
Well, I have an athlete right now that came to me. One of his reasons for coming to me, and he's in his 20s, was that I think I might have said that quote. Like, somebody asked me that question on one of the podcasts. Was like, what would you tell your 25-year-old self? And I was like, eat primally, dude. and that resonated with him, you know, because he's like 28 or something. So it's like, you know, step up and like start making the changes now before it's too late.
Right. So let's talk about the double and how, you know, you talked about how it came about. You know, kind of just felt it out and it just kind of came about kind of naturally. You saw Nick Clark's record, thought maybe you could go after it. But you got a calf strain right before Western, right? So how did that play into your mental preparation and
that
your mindset
tough.
Going
I mean,
in?
It was pretty dark around the Browning household in June. I just was really frustrated because I knew, for one thing, I knew that, you know, Ultra and Goo and Ultraspire had come together to, like, send Matt Trappi to follow me with a film crew or, like, with a camera. And so there was a lot of pressure there, you know. I don't usually get stressed out about hundreds, but I was a little stressed because I was just trying to, like, I was like, I got to get myself better. And it didn't really, you know, it took a good two and a half weeks before, like, I was on top of it. So I had to go really easy. I did a ton of cycling because it didn't aggravate it. And then I would come home and, like, run 20 minutes on it, you know, and really easy, like 11, 12-minute pace. And then I would, like, stop and go and, like, Epsom salt bath and get a massage and, like, all kinds of stuff. I spent a lot of money in June on massage. I was just trying to get him on top of it before I had to show up. And I knew I had enough big base from racing all because I'd raced Hurt. I'd raced that 100K in Kansas in April. And then had got through the training runs at Western States on Memorial Day. So I knew I had good base, and I knew I had a huge volume from the spring. So I wasn't concerned about fitness necessarily. I was bummed because I would normally have gone and done a couple more downhill workouts to get my quads ready, and I would have done a few more, like, longer tempo workouts just to get kind of, like, that long cruising pace efficiency down and get it, like, kind of really sharpened. And you don't get to sharpen. Basically, I had to skip sharpening.
Right.
The sharpening phase of training. So, and that's okay. I mean, I was fine, but I definitely, you know, felt that in the high country when I would get on, like, long runnable sections, I'd be like, normally I could cruise faster at the same heart rate. So, or at the same effort level. So I just had to kind of, like, kick back and just, you know, trust the process and know that after so many hundreds, I know that you don't have to necessarily be fast. You just have to be consistent.
Right.
And not slow down. So, or at least not fade too much, you know? I mean, you're going to fade a little in the second half. There's just nothing you can do about that. It's 100 miles, and usually you run the second 50 a little slower than you do the first, but they should be a pretty close split, you know, within a half an hour to 45 minutes. So if it's equal, kind of how hard they are, so... Yeah, that was tough. I mean, I got through it about a week out. I went and did a test run up in the mountains and here in Bend, and didn't think about it too much during that run. And that's when I was like, okay, I'm not feeling anymore. I think I'm going to be okay. But even, you know, even race day, I was being, like, I never was pushing off on my calf. Mm-hmm. Like, I was running, everything was, like, super smooth. I was trying to be, like, soft in everything I did. You know, like, whether it was, like, transitioning from power hiking to running or running to power hiking. I was never, like, in hammer mode. Mm-hmm. I was always in, like, smooth mode, you know.
Yeah. And hammer mode, or smooth mode, was still a third place mode.
Well, I didn't expect it to come back that much to me.
Right.
You know, I expected to, like, guys to come back to me, and you always do in 100. Mm-hmm. Like, when you go out easier, and I tend to, like, smell the barn pretty well the last 40 miles. But, you know, I was expecting, I really was shooting, you know, secretly for podium, but top five I really wanted, and then top 10 after that. So, you know, I had that on my radar, but I was stoked just to be in the top 10, like coming through Forest Hill. I think I had moved into eighth, or I was in eighth and maybe moved into seventh or something. I think I passed Charmin there or something. He was in aid station. And that's where I was like, you know, oh man, I'm stoked. I just kind of hold on to this place.
Yeah.
At this point. But then I'd come around the corner and there'd be another dude and I'd be like, oh, I'm gonna get another one. And so then I just started making a pact with myself the second half, like, not to let anyone pass me, because no one, you know, there's a bunch of jockeying in the first 20, 30 miles. And I think from about 23 or 24, 25 miles into the race, no one passed me after that. So, and I started, like, that started hitting me in the back of the head as far as a mental motivator. Like, and I'll do that. That's, I mean, that's little games I'll play with myself. I think that's one thing you have to do, in, especially in 100 milers, is second half so mental that you have to have these mental games that you can play with yourself, whether it's concentrating on your breath or making up these games like, okay, no one's passing me this next 40, for the next 40 miles, because, you know, no one passed me since 23. So if I could do that, that means I'm going to go almost like 75 miles. No one passing me at Western State. That'd be sweet. So, you know, playing those kind of games in your head, like, gives me a little more motivation. And the more guys I caught, the more motivated I got. And then I felt good too, you know.
Right.
I always, you know, if you feel bad, it's hard to be motivated. Mm-hmm. You know, if your stomach's going south, or, you know, your quads are blown or something like that. And I've had a few of those races over the years where it just didn't go quite according to plan and things kind of fell apart. And it's really hard to stay motivated during that time. But, you know, if you take care of yourself nutritionally and hydration, electrolyte balance, all that stuff, and you know how to take care of yourself and adjust for yourself, you know, there's a lot of experience in that. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that I'm more consistent now than I ever have been. It's just, it's more just long time doing it and kind of know myself. And definitely the fat adaptation works. I mean, that's worked for me really well, and I can tell a huge difference, especially in recovery.
Yeah. And right after Western finished, Dylan Bowman, I think, tweeted, and I've had him on the show, but he tweeted how it said, he said, look at Jeff Browning's splits, and it's like a textbook for 100 miler, like doing 100 miler. I can't remember what the word was, but, and I did, and you went from like 16th, and you just slowly, just, you know, you took it easy, like you said, you know, smooth on the first half, and you just worked your way up past those guys, didn't let anyone pass you, like you said, till the end there. And I think that was really awesome compared to everyone else. And, you know, I really loved seeing your race that day.
Yeah, thanks, man. That was, I have to say, it was satisfying for sure. You know, like when it goes like that.
Yeah.
You don't expect it always to go like that, but when it does, it's pretty awesome.
Right. And once you got over that calf injury, what did you feel, you know, good mindset-wise starting the race?
Yeah, totally. I did. I was up until about a week before the race, I mean, people would ask me, you know, hey, are you excited for Western States, man? You haven't been there forever. Like, it's going to be awesome, right? And I'd be like, yeah. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, no, oh, no, oh, no. But I just tried to push that down and, like, focus on getting it better. And, you know, I did a lot of research, and that's how I kind of – it was more self-diagnosis on a micro tear. I'm working with my masseuse, like, that we kind of self we kind of diagnosed that it was probably a micro tear because it wasn't getting better with massage, mm-hmm. which means it's there's something in the fiber, and that means it's not healing up. And right. so it just needs rest and needs time. And basically, it really started feeling better at about 15, 16 days. So after the incident of mm-hmm. when it got tight. So, right. Which is typical of if something healing up. So, that was, you know, I was fine once I got to the finish. You know, I just needed that one tester run 7 days out to make my mind, like, take a deep breath mm-hmm. and say, okay, I'm ready for this. We're going to make it to the start line, no problem.
Right. And then, you know, once you completed Western, you had something up with your foot, right, leading into Hard Rock?
Yeah. Maceration, so like, you know, when your feet get like pruney and then mm-hmm. it gets a fold in the skin. Uh-huh. So it was basically from staying wet the whole time mm-hmm. in Western States. You're wet and you're sweating in your shoes right. and you're dumping stuff on you at aid stations. And so your feet are getting soaking wet. It's going down into your shoes. Mm-hmm. So my feet were soaking wet. And so that's where I got, you know, I thought it was a blister, mm-hmm. but you know, it felt like a blister on the ball of my foot. But when I took it off, there was like no blister there. And then we started like, in the med temp, started looking, probing, and it's like, oh, there's a little fold about an inch and a half long right on the ball of my foot, and that's what the problem was. And so it hurt like crazy, so I had to really doctor that thing. I had to soak it, I worked on it, it peeled, because what it does is that skin dies mm-hmm. when it folds. It gets so pruney and saturated and moist that it folds over on itself, and then that little bit of skin dies that's in the fold. And so it just has to go through this process of like shedding it, and I had to wait on that. So when I, you know, only 19 days rest, it was still peeling. The night before Hard Rock, I was in my hotel room with scissors out, trimming off dead skin on the ball of my foot, trying to get it like smooth with an emery board and like trying to like get it ready, and mm-hmm. and it was all fresh skin, like pink, and I was just like super nervous. I'm trying to go a bunch of river crossings and 34,000 feet of downhill. Like, it can make you a little nervous, but it ended up being okay. You know, I felt it at mile like 18 or 19 at Hard Rock, I probably started feeling it there, and then like in the 20s I started feeling a little bit. And coming into Telluride, I knew that I needed to take care of it. So mm-hmm. I got in there and had my crew, Sean Meisner and Marco, and they totally like got my bag. And I said, I just came in and was like, normally I would have just been kind of blown right through the aid station, just grabbed new bottles and left. Mm-hmm. I said, no, man, I got to doctor my foot. Like, I need the lube. And I'd already had lube, and I found like, in between Western States and Hard Rock, I'd done a ton of research online trying to find a good lube that, like, adventure racers use, you know, because they're out for days with, like, wet, pruney feet.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I found this really good lube, and I've been testing it, and it seemed to be working okay. And it kind of creates a water barrier on your skin. So I just, like, gooped that stuff on, and then I said, I'm going to need that again at, like, at Uray. And so I just kept on it. And you see it in the film at Uray, I'm putting stuff on it.
Yeah.
And that's all I did, was just kept lube on it and then changed my socks about 60 miles to a new fresh pair, so there's no grit or mm-hmm. dirt in them, and wore gaiters. And the combination worked really well. Mm-hmm. Like, I ended up, it actually got better as the race progressed. So, like, the second half of the race, I hardly even noticed it. So it got better. And I did, you know, do some acrobatics trying to, with my poles and everything, trying to get across some water crossings without getting my feet wet. I was willing to go up and down the creek, you know, 30, 40 meters, just cross, instead of just barreling through.
Right.
And I really only had to get my feet really wet one time in the middle of the night. I just, there's one spot up in Spring Creek up in like around the Colorado or Continental Divide Trail. In the middle of the night, Pole Creek area. Mm-hmm. It's just like a marshy area, and it's like these kind of like stagnant ponds you cross, or it's almost like a series of like still streams that are all kind of up in this high basin. And mm-hmm. I got there, and there was no way to cross. You had to cross, and it was like, you know, crotch deep, and there's no way around it. So I just had to, like, go, okay, I'm getting wet. And but it was fine. It ended up being okay.
Yeah. And in those two, or, you know, not 2 weeks, but a few weeks between Hard Rock or Western and Hard Rock, what were you, just resting? You were obviously working on your foot. What were you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I just walked every day the first 7 days. Like, I always take 7 days off after 100 and just walk.
Mm-hmm.
Just get out lunch. And where I normally run at lunch, I just go for like a 40, 45-minute walk. And then that gets you moving again. I'll do one strength training program, workout maybe Wednesday or Thursday after the race, just to restore range of motion and that kind of thing, and get a massage at the end of the week. And then I started jogging like 20 to 40 minutes, starting on like Sunday after the race.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of ran. And then I went to Silverton a week early. So I got to Colorado on Friday. So 7 days before Hard Rock. And then I got up on the course. So I was hiking on the course, doing some easy running on the course, out on my feet for 3 or 4 hours, or 2 to 4 hours. Every day for the first 3 days I was there. So, like, I got there on Friday, and then Saturday, Sunday, Monday, I was on the course.
Mm-hmm.
Camping at Cunningham Gulch and scouting the course and just getting up and getting out. And so Sunday before the race, I did Handy's Peak, the 14er.
Mm-hmm.
So I just hiked it and with a little bit of running and summited and then kind of hiked and jogged down. Mm-hmm. It was about over four hours out. On Sunday morning, the week, was that 6 days, 5 days before the race. But, I did really, really mellow. And that's mainly just to get some acclimation. Go up high, come back down, sleep at 10:03 or 10:04 or whatever mm-hmm. Cunningham is at. And then, every day I was going up to 12, 13, 14, and then come back down for 3 or 4 days and then move into town 3 days before the race. And your body's like, oh, take a deep breath because you're at 9,300 feet. And you've been at 10,4 and going above that every day.
Right.
So town doesn't seem like very high after that.
Yeah. I had a mountaineer on a few weeks ago, and that's the same exact principle that they use when they're, doing Everest or other, 8,000-meter peaks.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Being acclimated is the biggest thing at Hard Rock, to be able to perform there.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause and even with my acclimation, strategy, I still don't lose it the last three climbs. The last three climbs in a sense of that course, it just keeps coming at you the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And after you go over Handies at, over the 100K mark, after that, I have one gear on the uphills. It's just hike uphill.
Yeah.
That's all you can do. I can't power hike hard. I can just hike. And that's all you can do. And you just kind of accept it. I can still run downhill fast. But I just can't power hike hard. I can't charge uphill. And so you just kind of have to accept it and roll with it, And you can definitely see that, coming up. And Little Giants, really, in that movie, The Double, when I come up at dawn, you can kind of see how slow I'm going. It's just oh, man. But that thing's hard. It's really steep, I mean, I think you climb from, 10... you're at 10.4 at Cunningham or 10.5, and then I think that tops out at 13.1 or something. So that climb is only 2.5 miles or something. So you do almost 4 grand,
right.
35 in less than 2.5 miles.
Yeah,
it's so steep, it's like a wall.
Yeah, you see it in the movie.
Yeah. What's that?
You see it in the movie totally. You can see the steepness.
Yeah, it's steep, and there's all these little false summits. You think you're that's got to be the top around this corner that I can't see over, and you get over the top and you're like, oh, there's a whole nother one, and then you go over that one and there's a whole nother one.
Yeah,
it keeps coming.
So what are you doing, in your training? You say you're doing fartleks and those long runs, obviously, just training as I would assume, but what are you doing to recover after the run? You strength training, of course, but any functional exercises, any yoga, anything like that?
I do some, I do a couple of things. I have a lunge matrix thing I do. That's all every plane of motion
mm-hmm.
with lunges. I do some, yoga style stretching moves, before I go to bed. I foam roll,
mm-hmm.
Especially the 5-inch, trigger point ball or
right.
Those foam balls or mm-hmm. I think, you know, Pro-Tech makes one too. Both of those, like those, that brand, either one of those brands, I have both of those actually. I travel with that thing. If I go on the road, that ball goes with me in my bag. So that's how I like, keep my hips loose, work on my low back and that kind of thing. What else? I mean, strength training once a, like I do strength training twice a week. I do one with weights once a week, and then mm-hmm. I do a body workout, like where it's pull-ups, push-ups, planks, right. and air squats. Mm-hmm. I do that once a week, which I did yesterday. And tomorrow I teach a class where I do a strength training class where it's like a what I call the Bronco Billy Power Pack. And it's upper body, lower body with dumbbells, some plyometrics and core work and push-ups to core. Comboed up and all timed in like a 20-minute workout. Mm-hmm. So total 30-minute workout, 5 minutes warm up, 20 minutes of work, 5 minute cool down,
right.
stretching and stuff. So, I teach at a local place called Recharge, which is kind of like a recovery lounge for endurance athletes in town.
Nice. So, one of the most to me impressive things about your running is the fact that while many other, even professional ultra runners are having trouble recently, completing 100 miler for the whole year. You've done already 4 this year, and you are doing these big races more than one time during the year and injury free mostly and competitively. So how do you keep up that, endurance throughout the whole year?
I think part of it is like what I think people, don't, when they look at it, they're like, wow, it's crazy. But I also have a lot, like, decades of work under my belt.
Right.
So you have to remember, I played sports from, like, 4 or 5 years old, 40 times a year, like, traditional sports, mm-hmm. until I was graduating from high school. And then I got into, like, I was running a little bit, like, not a ton, but, maybe 3 days a week, like, 20, 30 minutes. In college, mm-hmm. Just to stay kind of fit. I was lifting weights. I was lifting weights from like seventh grade on. So I've been lifting strength training since seventh grade, have been doing endurance work. If I look at like playing football and track, I was 2 big seasons a year. I was doing endurance training.
Mm-hmm.
In college I was mountain biking. And then in my 20s, I was mountain biking, climbing, and running. So I was running casually. I had a dog, and so I would just run her like 3 or 4 days a week, 20, 30 minutes, 40 minutes. But I was mountain biking like 4 days a week and strength training. So like since I've been in like 13, mm-hmm. I've been doing some form of training, whether it's strength training, endurance training, of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a bunch of different kinds. So, it was very cross training and, plus working, hard labor, like manual labor on a farm, I ran a hay crew in the summer. So I was working out and we had to come into the gym 27 times in the winter or in summer. If you wanted to start on Friday nights in football and fall, our coach made us come in and strength train early in the mornings. So I was coming in all strength training year round from seventh grade through senior year in high school. So there's a ton of base there of strength and endurance and all that stuff. And then I started, ultra running in like when I was like 28. And so that's been like almost 17 years now of just ultra running specific.
Right.
But before that, I had a huge base. So you have to look at it almost 30 some years, 35 years of endurance training and strength training under my belt. So that you have to understand that's where I'm coming from. Like I wasn't strictly a runner. Like you see a lot of ultra runners come from running background only. I had a bunch of other stuff. So I was very well rounded.
Right.
And so I think the culmination of all those things. And plus, I didn't, when I first started running hundreds in 2002, I only did 1 a year. And then starting in 07, I started doing 2 a year.
Mm-hmm.
So I do 1 and they're way spread apart. So I do like early summer one and then I do a fall one.
Right.
And then, so you have plenty of time to recover and get ready for it and do other shorter stuff in between as trainers. And then And then, you know, I think 2014 was the first time I did more than two in a season. So I did four in 2014, three in 2015, and then four in 2016.
Right.
So, and that's kind of, you know, and I definitely, like, was paying the piper a little bit after 2014 because I had some health issues in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started shifting my diet, like, mm-hmm. at the end of 2015. And that's where I've really seen a difference with recovery and, you know, maintaining weight and all those kinds of things. You know, I think that shift has been pretty, you know, with having the performances I had this year, I definitely chalked that up to diet,
mm-hmm.
And experience. You know, experience right. is definitely plays into that, man. I mean, 20 some hundreds, you know, when I've towed the, you know, Western States is my 24th hundred. So you have to remember that that's a lot different than your third hundred.
Right, exactly.
You know, I couldn't have done what I did this year even 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this whole sport is about experience and about older, not, you know, older, just as much, you know, it's an older sport. It's not something that, you know, 20-year-olds are the best in. It's the people who know what's going on. And, well, you know, yeah. usually, yeah. And,
yeah, we're starting to see it.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool, you know. But they're also, you know, you have to look at, like, you know, it, we're starting to see parents influence kids, and those kids are becoming 20-some years old now.
Right.
So, you know, their parents were ultra runners. Before that, you didn't hear of anyone who was an ultra runner got into it because it was a new sport.
Right.
You know? But now we're seeing, like, a second generation of ultra runners where their parents were ultra runners, and then they grew up around ultra running, and they ran with their parents, and they grew up around races and the scene. And so when they hit 20, you know, they may, you know, run their first 50K in their teens. That changes, man. If you've, during development, started doing some endurance running and didn't get injured, you know, like, if you're just playing at running, which is, you know, basically what I'm drawing a blank, but he's from Oregon and at the one Western States.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm drawing a blank. Anyway.
Yeah.
We know who we're talking about, right?
Yeah, the winner of Western States this year.
I'm gonna feel bad because I've talked to him so many times, but he's awesome. Like because he grew up around, you know, parents that were ultra runners. He started running early and got into it casually and just kind of progressed as his body matured. You know, he didn't really start racing until he was like 17 or 18, mm-hmm. when he's more mature. Like his metabolic system is more mature, right? If we look at males, they're really start to really mature at about 17 or 18 as far as the metabolic system. And if you look at, like, their late great Arthur Lydiard as a coach, one of his quotes, or this is paraphrased, but basically, if you can keep a kid, a child, from racing, and you can get them just to play at running,
mm-hmm.
until they're 18, you have the makings of an Olympian. So that's a great quote, and I think that should soak in with people in the way, especially in America, the way we drive our, you know, sub-18-year-old kids in track and cross-country. It's intervals, intervals, hard intervals, running, running, running hard, and that gets them fast quick, but at the detriment of their metabolic system.
Right, and so longevity.
Understanding that, like, you shouldn't be putting pressure on kids right now. They should have a fun at it, and they should play at running. And, you know, I think that's what we're seeing with you know, with some of these young guys that are coming up. They came up with parents that are ultra runners, so they ran easy, right? And they didn't get into track and cross country and, like, hammer a bunch of hard miles. They just went and ran in the woods.
Right.
And I think that's where you're getting, that's what's awesome, because the speed will come, you know, once the metabolic system's mature. Like, you can work it hard and it can handle the work. But before that, it messes with, like, growth plates, and it messes with, like, you know, testosterone and all kinds of other things, right? So that's something that I think you're going to see more and more fast young guys, because they're coming at it, you know, as a second generation ultra runner.
Right, exactly. And you run with your son, right? The oldest one?
Yes, and I run with all my kids.
Oh, okay.
And my wife runs a little bit, and so I don't give any pressure to them. I don't make them have to do anything. Mm-hmm. I like, if they want to run with me, if they don't want to run with me, that's cool. I do try to motivate my son a little bit, my oldest, he's 14, to just get out and run 20 minutes, you know? Like, he has a GPS watch, and he's old enough to go out on his own. Like, if he wants to go out with his headphones on and just go cruise on some trails, then I encourage that. I'd rather him have a kind of his own personal relationship with running than being motivating him to like, hey man, you've got to run this many miles and and all that stuff. You know, I don't adhere to that. If he wants to race, you know, my youngest, I would guess, who's 5, he's like a go getter. Like he's the one that's like comes after me like, Dad, you need to go run. Or if I'm not feeling like running, he's like, Dad, come on, run. I'm like, I don't really feel like running. He's like, you're an ultra runner. Like, come on. So, you know, it just depends on, like, personality, too. Like, every kid did a little different personality-wise, so some are going to be more motivated, self-motivated than others. You know, I'm very self-motivated. So, and that's why I've been able to, train consistently for 17 years of ultra running. It's just I like getting out and I like doing it, so... You know, I don't have too much trouble with motivation, only occasionally, but rarely.
Right. Yeah, and my dad is the one who got me into ultra running, so it's kind of like the same story for me, I guess, is what you were describing here. And speaking of story, you know, and you talked about earlier in the podcast how you want to be, you know, running when you're 80, and I think your philosophy of how it's just, you know, the love of the trail and just getting out there and running is very similar to my neighbor, actually. He's, I think, 75 now or 77, and he ran Western and Angeles Crest, you know, way back when they first started, and he was, you know, one of the guys running with the, you know, rubbing alcohol bottles and stuff, and he's just, you know, did it for the love, and he's still running, not, you know, hundreds, but he's still out there running on the trails around town. So
cool.
Yeah,
that's what I want to be. That guy, I want to be like the guy like jogging around town, and everybody's like, that dude's really old. Yeah, wow, that's what I want to be.
Yeah, he's still out there. So, you know, we're almost done because I know you said you want to get out by 4. So, I just want to talk a little bit about your coaching and how did you, you know, get into that, and then what's your kind of philosophy on coaching?
Sure. Well, I've always kind of, I've been my own coach for 17 years. So I do a ton of reading and obviously like what we talked about earlier, like I like to hound dog things out. And so I've done a ton of reading over the years and different philosophies, and I probably most align with Arthur Lydiard's kind of stuff on endurance training. Kind of, you know, if you go to like the Lydiard Foundation, you can find some more information on that. But more that it's like, you know, a big base, you know, periodization and a big base of aerobic base before you add like strength base of some sort, where you're doing more hills first before speed, then building speed, then building volume. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I approach, you know, kind of most of my coaching in that respect. Everyone, like I said, everyone's a puzzle. So some people, you know, because I'm doing customized coaching right now, I definitely customize every schedule according to, you know, people are busy and they have kids or they have jobs, you know, and I understand that because I do it too. And have had to balance that for a long time. And so coming up with like time-saving things and tips, you know, combining workouts if we can, you know, like a, you know, treadmill hill climb with a strength training thing at the gym, you know, once a week. If someone's really crunched for time and we want to get a strength session in, well, let's get a run session in to warm up for the strength training, you know, and that kind of thing. So combining workouts a little bit, so that's some of the stuff I've come up with over the years. The others is I'm not a big, unless someone wants to, I'm not a big, like, I'm not going to give you a bunch of track sessions or anything like that. You know, because most of the people that are coming to me are doing just like ultra running and trail races. So I'd rather you go out with the beauty of GPS watches is that you can do speed work anywhere.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm basing stuff on, you know, minutes, or, you know, intervals on minutes, and you can go run it on a, like, you know, pathway or, you know, something that's softer surface, rather than running around in circles around a track. Unless someone really wants to. And like, I'm totally, you know, I don't go to the track too often. Every once in a while I do, but I do most of my, you know, speed work and quality work, tempo work, hill work, are on like a rolling pathway, which is like kind of little tiny gravel. Mm-hmm. So it's like a nice kind of pretty consistent surface. But so you can run fast, but it's got rollers in it. So you have to climb uphill and downhill in some sections that are really short. And I think that's more realistic to the kind of running ultra runners are doing and people who want to go run trail races. Well, even if someone wants to go run a 5K, there's going to be a couple hills in it.
Right.
Most 5Ks, you know, so, that's kind of, you know, how I got into it. I just started really launched it officially this year. My endurance coaching business. I'd been coaching people on and off over the years here and there. And I've been talking about it for years, and actually it's really Ian Sharman that got me like thinking like I should really do this, because mm-hmm. he was like, you've got to do this while you're like while you're still like a fast athlete and like so people, you know, you can make that transition to being a coach. And he's like, you're obviously, you know, geeky about it and a student of the sport, so he's like, you're going to be a good coach. And and so he kind of inspired me to kind of just, you know, follow that out and follow my heart. Mm-hmm. And so I thank him for that, because, you know, he really pushed me to do that. So, and it's been awesome. I mean, I have to say, I love doing it. You know, I'm still doing some design work, but I'm coaching, you know, 11 athletes right now, and I really enjoy it, and I'm getting good feedback from them and good testimonials. And so I'm in the process of expanding that business and backing off on design work. You know, so, I mean, ideally I would love to be coaching full time. Mm-hmm. So that's my goal in the next couple of years, is to kind of phase out, you know, still do some design work, but not do as much and do more and more coaching. Cause I just like helping people. It's really cool and it's rewarding and it's inspiring to see someone, you know, like be missing the cutoffs at an ultra race and then show up and be able to finish, or someone who's in some chronic DNFs and hundreds and finish, you know.
Right.
And you know, or I just had an athlete that's 62 finish Run Rabbit Run and come back 2 weeks later and qualify for Boston at St. George Marathon.
Wow.
Yeah. And he I'm coaching him in diet too, so there's some recovery, aided recovery and diet there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was already a long time ultra runner, but he was, you know, he was definitely had some DNFs under his belt in the last couple of years, and he was getting frustrated and he felt like he needed a change. And, it's been cool to help him, because it's been really inspiring to me to see someone like, you know, when he said he wanted to do St. George Marathon 2 weeks after Run Rabbit Run, I was like, dude, I don't know, man. But he did it, and he's like, I'm just going to go run. And he goes, well, on the outside chance, I kind of want to qualify for Boston, which meant like a three, I think for his age group, it's like three, sub 350. And he ran like a 330. So he hammered it, dude. I was like so like inspired. Like I couldn't believe it. He was just hammering off 8 minute miles. And he said he felt great. And so it kind of shocked him too. He was just like, there is no way prior to this diet shift that I could have done this. So mm-hmm. He's like, man, it's like I felt hammered for 3 weeks or 4 weeks after 100. And he goes, it's just like blowing my mind how fast I'm recovering at 62. So that's really inspiring to me, that I've found something, that I'm kind of on the right track, you know, as far as like dietary changes. It just seems like I've had some really cool feedback from a few athletes that have been doing it and made the shift. So anyway, it's been fun. It's been really fun. I love coaching. And like I said, I want to continue to do it. It's really cool.
Right. Yeah. And it seems like it's given a lot back to you, just in your enthusiasm for it right now.
Oh man, it's so like inspiring. Like I have to say, like during the day when I'm supposed to be on a design project, it's hard to like put down the coaching, take off the coaching hat, because I just want to go like talk to my athletes or like look at their training schedule or whatever, you know, and instead of like going and working on a design project because it's due and I got a deadline. So it's been fun.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I bet. So I just have three little inspirationals, and then we'll be done. So they're little quick questions. So first off, a book that you love or that you would want to read still?
Let's see. A book that I want to read. I mean, I have to say that, well, I'll give you a few books. Can I give you a couple books?
Yeah, yeah, it's even better.
anyone who's interested in diet should read Primal Blueprint. If it's a really cool, I like his lifestyle approach to diet and like kind of our, you know, our hunter-gatherer DNA. I think that's, it's a really cool approach, and I just like how he's kind of put it into these like 10 tips type the way he just approaches it. It's cool. Like, it's just like a good lifestyle approach.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is The Big Fat Surprise. From a nutritional standpoint, just understanding how fat and it's actually a pretty really interesting read too. A woman spent 9 years researching and writing this book. It's on the how fat and cholesterol got demonized in our mm-hmm. And then became policy in the United States, and how it's driven how our medical profession treats cholesterol, and how it's really not a great biomarker for heart disease, and like it'll kind of like open your eyes to like not being afraid of fat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my generation especially has grown up with fat free,
yeah,
and thinking fat clogs your arteries, when we realize that it's probably more has to do with too much glucose in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And something to do with insulin, you know,
right.
And insulin response. So, and sugar. Mm-hmm. And so, it's a really interesting eye opening book for me. It was for me at least, when I made this shift to a diet. And then the last one is probably, Yvon Chouinard's, Let My People Go Surf. that's a great book. And if everybody's ever thinking about a business or approaching like an idea and following your heart, like, it's a cool book to put it in perspective of like how to approach, you know, business and how we should be approaching business, and everyone should be approaching business. So, those are probably my top three, I would say
right now.
I mean, I read all the time, dude. So
yeah,
I'm always reading. So, actually I'm right in the middle of reading a philosophy book, on how the mind works and how we have two systems of thinking, fast and slow, and, it's called Thinking Fast and Slow, but it's a really chunky, like, cerebral book. So it's one of those, like, I always read a fiction and a nonfiction. So I'm reading a fiction and then I'm reading that as my nonfiction. And so I have to read like sometimes a chapter, sometimes just two pages and like think on it.
Yeah.
And then walk away from it for a day and then come back to it. So, but it's super interesting and how it shapes our belief system and how our intuitive thinking is, you know, tied to our like effortful thinking, and it's really interesting.
Right.
But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a race that you would still love to do.
There's a couple out there that I haven't done that have been on my list for a long time. Bear 100 is probably number one.
Nice.
Massanutten's another one. And on the East Coast.
Oh, okay.
And AC.
Oh, okay.
I think those are my three that are bucket list items that I still haven't done that are like kind of been around for a while and I really want to do.
Right.
So AC is really freaking hard to get into. And Massanutten too. So both of those are on my list. I always forget when you have to enter for them, and I need to put it on my calendar because, you know, but I'm trying to figure out my schedule for next year. I just entered Western States today because I got the special invite because of the top 10. And,
mm-hmm.
Casey Lichting beat me, though. She was the first one to enter out of the list. I was number two. But anyway, I'm looking forward to Western States, and I think I'm going to go back to UTMB next year. So
awesome. Awesome. And finally, do you meditate?
When I have any kind of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, couple businesses, training, wife and three kids. I do practice being grateful
mm-hmm.
on a daily basis. I carry around a rock in my pocket. It's my great gratitude rock. So anytime I touch that rock, I have to say things I'm grateful for. So it keeps me in that attitude of gratitude,
right?
You know. So I do that, and I do practice like visualization. Mm-hmm. So. You know, visualizing the way you want things to go versus dwelling on why they're not going your way.
Right.
Or if your day is going bad, you know, even if you stub your toe, like trying to refocus your visualization, you know, visualize having a good day, like, you know, a parking spot opening up when you're looking for one, that kind of stuff, instead of going, oh man, no, I need a parking spot. Oh, I'm behind, I'm late. You know, instead just like taking a deep breath, nose breathing and going, there's one going to open up like in just a second.
Right.
And most of the time it does.
Yeah.
And so I think visualization is really important. And I think meditation isn't too. I think that doing both of those, I just, you know, I'm sure as I get older and my kids are out of the house, I'll meditate more.
Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm pretty busy. So I just try to visualize and I try to be grateful all day. So that makes me take a moment. If one of my kids comes into my office and says, Dad, can you come hang this up in my room? You know, my drawing. You know, my old Jeff, before I was doing that, old Jeff would said, no, not right now. I'm busy with work. You know, now I sit there and take a deep breath and go, you know what? Yeah, let's go do it real quick and go take care of it and then come back and work.
Right.
And then it makes his day. And then I feel good that I helped him and then I can, you know.
Yeah, refocus just, even on work.
Yeah, I think you got to put that out in the universe, man. You got to really like push it out there and say, you know, put good out, you know,
yeah.
Well, on good emotions, because those drive your 60,000 thoughts a day.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So thanks a lot for coming on the show, Jeff. It was fun and I really enjoyed it. So thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Darren.
And that was Jeff Browning. Thanks again, Jeff, for coming on the show. Like I said at the end there, it was really fun. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot about Jeff. I learned a lot about his philosophy, and I hope you guys did too. I love talking to him about the double this year, about Western and Hard Rock. I love learning about how he, you know, completes that longevity and how he is totally right that it is about experience in those, you know, years and decades even of training and of just being an active person and loving the sport, and the fact that, you know, he endures just by loving it. And you can totally hear that in the way he talks about it and his personality of researching and just, you know, finding out what he, you know, following by the nose, like he said a bunch of times, that just getting all the information he can, and you really see the love for that, for everything he does. And the fact that, you know, he has a business in the graphic design business, but he loves coaching even more than that, it seems right now. And he's just really enjoying that whole aspect of helping others. And I think, you know, just the idea that he's loving that coaching, and I hope that is showing to the athletes that he is helping. And especially with that 62-year-old, I think that easily showed with doing a 100-miler and a marathon and qualifying for Boston. So, I hope you guys learned a lot. I hope you guys enjoyed this discussion with Jeff. He was a funny guy. I really, really enjoyed it. And it was totally worth the wait. Totally everything I expected and more. He was really great. So if you want to find out more about what he's up to, of course, go to GoBroncoBilly.com. Follow him on social media at the same, you know, GoBroncoBilly, same address, same account. And just go out and read those books. I think I most definitely will read those books that he recommended. And just, I think the end there, the way we finished it off, talking about gratitude is a perfect way to end it. Let's all go out this week and try to love what we do a little bit more, just like Jeff, and kind of just be more grateful for what we do. And just spread that love out there into the universe so it can come back around to us, and we can get that happiness back applied to us. And just let's all be a little bit more grateful for what we have and what we can do and what we're willing to do, especially when it comes to 100-milers, and especially when it comes to work, and especially when it comes to stress. Gratitude and love for hard things and for easy things is something that we tend to forget a lot. And I think Jeff did a very eloquent way of reminding us all to remember that. So go out and be more grateful and be more loving of what you have. Endure a little bit more, and just have fun. So thanks again for coming on, Jeff. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you want to find out more what I'm up to, of course, go to the website, touchingthetrail.com. And if you guys enjoyed this episode and if you enjoy the podcast, I would love it if you can leave a review on iTunes. That helps so much and just really extends my reach for the podcast with iTunes algorithm and such. So enjoy your week. Listen to this podcast again if you really enjoyed it, because I know I did, and I probably will listen to it a few times. And just remember to be a little bit more grateful. So thanks again, and I'll see you guys next week. the Touching the Trail podcast.